It's very strange to have a historian and an economist on the same program. I was joking with Professor Harris earlier that if economics is correct, history could not have existed. It's logically impossible according to everything you're taught in the economics department here. On the other hand, if history actually existed, then everything you're taught in economics is a parallel universe science fiction. They're incompatible. The economists say that money and interest and credit, all begun by individuals bartering, as if you were Alan Greenspan and Ayn Rand, somehow on a desert island, very selfishly deciding how to truck and barter, trying to make a profit off each other. May they each win. But if you look at history, this isn't what happened. Randy began with a bone that he said was 50,000 years old. It wasn't. It was 28,000 years old. He couldn't read it. My friend Alex Marshak at Harvard University at the Peabody Museum can read it. It was a calendar bone of the movements of the moon. The job of the chieftain in the Paleolithic societies that Alex described was to keep the calendar, because all social and economic life centered around the movements of the season, the calendar, bringing people together at the solstices or equinoxes in chief parts. And the reason I mention this is that money and credit and interest and enterprise all can only be understandable once you understand the calendar, which is not taught in the economics courses, but I'll explain what I mean. In these primitive societies, from the Ice Age down to the Stone Age and into the Bronze Age, and even today in the tribal societies that anthropologists talk about, it's considered very impolite to try to make money. If there were somebody like Alan Greenspan or Ayn Rand, and if one of them were the chieftains, they would be thrown out of their chieftains. It's considered bad manners. In Australia, they say the nail that stands up from the wood gets hammered down. And the reason is, in a low surplus society, if somebody makes a lot of money or a profit, they make it off somebody else. And society cannot afford to have wealthy people make money at other people's expense, pushing them below the break-even point so that they are unable to support themselves, unable to have their own land. Because if you do this, then what's going to happen? The people will emigrate and just leave the society. Or as we Irish say about modern elections, we vote with our backsides. In that case, they do what they do. When Alan Greenspan's and neoliberal policies are imposed on Latvia, the working force emigrates. When it's imposed on Greece, the working force emigrates. This has gone back over tens of thousands of years. So what happened in the development of Western civilization was there was one part of the world where it was necessary to have a surplus. Because while the ideal of every early society was to be self-sufficient, everybody had to grow their own foodstuffs, it's almost as primitive as if you lived in, say, modern-day Moscow, where you have to have a country dacha to grow your food, to bring in to that. Most people in the ancient Near East had plots on the land to support themselves, whether they lived on the land or in the cities. However, this Mesopotamia in the Near East had this rich soil that was deposited by rivers for millions of years, very rich, good for growing crops, but because it was all deposited by rivers, it didn't have metal, it didn't have stone, and they didn't have even very much hardwood, so they had to trade. Now the question is, if you're going to settle in a country like modern, which is where modern Iraq is, how are you going to get the metal and the raw materials that you need to make the Bronze Age, to make the metal implements you needed to do farming and other things? The solution was to essentially set up public institutions, the temples and the palaces, and basically these evolved out of the chieftains' households, but somehow the chieftains were, it was a multi-ethnic society of Semites, Sumerians, nobody quite knows where they come from, other groups, and they had to agree on a kind of honest broker of standardization. And the first standardization, the origins of almost all of the economic enterprise that we have today, money, coinage, debt, payment of interest, contracts, legacies, all of these agreements come from one part of the world, Sumer, basically in the 3rd millennium BC, from about 3200 BC to about 1200 BC. So the palaces basically had were where the economic surplus was organized, and the palace, just as chieftains in an anthropology society would support the widows and orphans and other dependents, the cripples, in their households, so the temples of Sumer did this. When I say widows and orphans, it's always very confusing to an economic audience. Widows and orphans in antiquity did not have trust funds. Today you say we have to keep the interest high or the widows and orphans can't live. The widows and orphans were actually not the richest people of society as they are today. They were actually the poorest people of society. So in the Bible, when they talk about widows and orphans, they're not talking about the billionaires who the presidents are talking about when they say we need to keep wages low and interest rates high so the widows and orphans can get their standardized income. Well, anyway, the temples would essentially employ them in the weaving workshops. They would consign the textiles and the weaving things to traveling merchants, and the merchants would take something worth, say, 5 minas, and in 10 years, or 5 years, they would have to give back twice as much, double the sum. That was the origin of interest. It was supposed to approximate what the merchants would get. And as it happened, the 5 years was a period of 60 months. And so the standard of the dollar they used, the standard of value, the mina, was divided into 60 shekels, just like minutes and seconds are 60ths, come from that period of the time. So you had a doubling time of debt of 5 years. Now, you also gradually had the public institutions in charge of unused land or free land that wasn't settled. This land was lent out to cultivators or sharecroppers for one-third of the crop. And based on this one-third of the crop, interest rates were also charged at one-third. And basically, land would be advanced, perhaps cattle. If people needed money, that would be advanced. And that we have even a function called the ale women. They'd go to a bar and they'd run up a tab at the bar. Now, the interesting thing is these debts were owed in barley. And one of the first things that many rulers did in the ancient Near East, the first thing they would do would be to announce a set of prices. And in Hammurabi's laws, for instance, one shekel of silver was the equivalent of 1 liter of barley. So if you made barley, you could pay in barley. There was also a rate of exchange with sheep, with wool, with other ways of paying debts. So the original money was a price schedule to enable people to pay in kind. And the barley, obviously people did not go around with barley in the pocket because it really doesn't last very well. People didn't use money actually to pay. What they would do during the crop year, they would do essentially what somebody would do at a bar today. They run up a tab, and they would run up a tab with the alewoman for money that would be due on the threshing floor at the seasonal harvesting time. And in fact, almost all the barley debts, and we have the contracts from Mesopotamia, were due on the threshing floor at barley time. The silver debts were due at another time. This was the principle that lasted until about 1200 BC. Then, instead of global warming now, there was a global freezing then. There was a dark age. We sort of lose statistics and writing for until about 750 BC. Then what you had was a gradual recovery, and you had traders coming from Syria and Phoenicia across the Mediterranean to Greece and antiquity. That's when civilization began to go downhill. It's usually considered the start of Western civilization. But what people think is the start of Western civilization was the falling apart of Near Eastern origins of civilization, of this economy that had been put together in a very well-organized economy. And all of a sudden, instead of the public institutions, you had local chieftains occurring. And in Rome, very soon, you had the aristocratic families overthrow the kings. And the functions that were in the public sector in the Near East all of a sudden were taken over by private families. Let's call them the mafia, because that's basically what the Roman oligarchy was. And there was a complete change in policy from the Near Eastern Bronze Age to classical antiquity. When a new ruler would come to the throne in Mesopotamia, the first thing they would do on their first full year of the throne was to proclaim a clean slate. And that's because a lot of the debts that were denominated in barley couldn't be paid. If there, if you look at Hammurabi's laws again from 1750 BC, if there was a flood, the debts were annulled. If there was a drought, the debts were annulled. If there was military hostilities and they couldn't be paid, the debts were annulled. And there was a general understanding that the debts tended to grow faster than the means to pay. Now, we have the mathematical training texts that scribes were taught in Babylonia in 2000 BC. And you can imagine my surprise after teaching graduate economics for many years here in New York at the New School that I found that the mathematics used in 2000 BC were far superior to the mathematical models being used today. Not simply because they had to use, the scribes had to learn quadratic equations, but because they had two basic contrasts. They had the doubling time of debt. One of the exercises was how long does it take a minute to double in value? The answer is 5 years. How long does it take to quadruple in value? 10 years. How long does it take for it to multiply 62 times? The answer is 30 years. So you knew that here's this exponential curve of debt very rapidly. What they also had were curves for the growth of herds and output. And that was an S-curve, just like almost all economic statistics today show an S-curve. But what you have, and I'll show you shortly, is the tendency of the debts to grow faster than to be paid. So the rulers, when they came in, would cancel the debts for a very good reason. Unfortunately, in Babylonia and Sumer, there was never an explanation book, here's how we do things. But one of the Roman historians wrote the explanation he was given by the Egyptians for why the pharaohs canceled the debts. They said, if we don't cancel the debts, then the debtors are going to fall into bondage to the creditors, as you can read in the Bible, and then nobody's going to fight in the army and will be defeated. And so in order to keep a land-tenured army, we have to return the land to the people who've lost them to the creditors. We have to free them from bondage. Otherwise, everybody's going to leave. There will be depopulation, and we'll be defeated. In the 3rd century BC, a Greek general called who went under the name of Tacitus wrote a manual for how to conquer a town and how to defend a town. If you want to conquer a town, you say, I'm going to cancel your debts, and you'll get the people on your side. If you want to defend a town, you say, I'm going to cancel the debts of everybody, you know, as soon as we win. That's what Zedekiah did in Rome, but the Romans were mafiosi, and he went back on his word. No, that's what Coriolanus did in Rome. That's what Shakespeare's play was all about, went back on his word. Same thing in Judah. Zedekiah in the Bible promised to cancel them. He didn't. That's what makes the first millennium BC very different from the Bronze Age. Well, what happened by the time of 133 BC was in Rome, you had basically a Milton Friedman philosophy of free markets by the oligarchy. And what they realized in Rome was exactly what President Nixon and Henry Kissinger realized in Chile. You can't have a free market for creditors if you don't murder everyone who disagrees with you. If you don't kill everyone who wants to cancel the debts, if you don't kill everyone who knows history, if you don't kill the labor leaders, you can't have a free market oligarchy style. So they murdered the Gracchi, they murdered the supporters of the debt cancellation, And essentially, there was a 100-year social war in Rome. And the result was that by the time the empire got going, one quarter of the Roman population was in debt bondage or outright slavery. So I'm going to do a little fast forward to the modern era. At the time of the American Revolution, in the medieval time, after the Dark Age, you had something new that didn't occur in antiquity. You had public debts. No, and all these debts were for war debts. Basically, it began with the Templars, and after the Crusades, and then the Venetians and the Genoese, the big bankers lending to kings in order to wage war. By the time of the Napoleonic Wars, 75% of Britain's budget, the public budget, was spent on debt service. So at the time of the American Revolution, Adam Smith, Reverend Richard Price, and other people sent congratulations to the American revolutionists. They said, let them go free. It's not worth waging war. I'm not sure how to go down with this, but here is a chart that was done in 1776 by Richard Price, who said, if one penny was saved at the rate of 5% at the time of Jesus, this penny would now be a solid sphere of gold extending from the sun out to the planet Saturn. I actually recalculated it would go all the way to the planet Uranus. He was trying to show the impossibility of ever trying to pay the national debt as it amounted to. Now, we know that there were many rich people that did save pennies in the time of Jesus. In fact, Seneca, the philosopher, made up over 20% on his loans to Asia Minor. Cicero made a lot of loans. None of these debts ever were repaid because, again and again, there was a collapse when there was a bankruptcy. The debtor would fall into bondage. The good thing about bankruptcy and about modern bankruptcy laws is not only is the debt canceled, but something even better happens. The savings are canceled. And today, you have 90% of the savings and net savings in America held by the upper 10% of the population. These are the population today that are trying to do to the American economy what the oligarchy did in Rome, basically, which is to impose a kind of debt peonage on the population, where you have a situation that if you buy a house, you have to take a 30-year mortgage and essentially spending the rest of your life paying off the mortgage debt to get a place to live, whereas land used to be free to all citizens originally. To get an education, you have to now take a student loan out that is going to absorb your income for 10 or 20 years, that is not subject to the bankruptcy laws, that cannot be wiped out, that essentially, whether you get a job or not, you have to pay. The result is that many students, as I'm sure most of you know, who are not able to get jobs have to live with their parents. The parents have to pay the loan. The Republican presidential candidate, Mitt Romney, said, we'll borrow the money from your parents and repay, you know, because they're not going to dun you, like you're reading about in the Wall Street Journal, is happening with student loans. You're having the entire society now loaded so down with debt that one quarter of American real estate owes a larger debt than the money is available for. So what you're having is essentially money is debt deflation. That's why we're having the bad employment statistics that on Monday, you remember, or the day after President Obama's speech, out came the employment figures, and every newspaper article of almost every economic statistic has two words, unexpected and surprising. Well, yesterday, there are new the Financial Times reported the new consumer credit in America. And it says consumer credit in the U.S. unexpectedly fell in July. And then it said nobody, who could have thought, debt reveal surprised fall in debt. Well, here's what happens. People have to pay off the debts or they get the dunning phone calls that many of you as students might get. If you pay the creditor, you are not able to buy goods and services. Something has to give. And in America, you have about 40% of the American workers' budget going to pay for housing. 15% of the wages are taken out for Social Security and Medicare as loans to the government. Instead, whereas Randy has said, the government doesn't really need this money. The government says, well, we want to keep wages down. We want to keep spending power down. So we're making you pre-save for Social Security so that we have a huge fund that now that we have this money, we can afford to cut taxes on the rich. So that, and pretend that somehow the whole thing is in balance until you have the Bowles-Simpson Commission that says, well, we can't afford to pay. We only pay the rich, not the Social Security people. After all, that basically is the political dynamic we have here. So what you're having as a result of the government absorbing money for debt service and the government bailing out the banks with a $13 trillion worth of bank giveaways is that the debts have been left in place for the American economy at such a high rate that the corporations must pay a high amount of money. If you're hiring a worker here, you have to pay the worker a high enough money to pay 40% of his income for housing, 15% for Social Security, 15% for other debt, and about 10% in other taxes. So before the worker has enough money even to begin buying goods and services, 75 to 80% of his income goes to the finance, insurance, and real estate sector. And the economy, basically, is two economies. Well, the result is that, at least in America, things have been kept going because the Federal Reserve and the government, basically, has been able to keep monetizing enough money to keep the economy from collapsing. That's not the case in Europe. Every central bank was founded to do just exactly what Randy has said, to monetize the government debt, mainly the war debt, but basically to create money and say, here's money, we're spending it into the economy. This growth in debt in every country is what has provided the private sector with enough money to keep growing and transacting goods and services. For the first time in modern history, under the Clinton administration, he actually ran a budget surplus. That meant the government was not spending money into the economy. That people had to borrow from the banks at interest. So when the government balanced the budget, this was a bonanza for the banks because now they would lend to people. And Alan Greenspan said, borrow against your house. You can always sell it to the greater fool 3 years down the road. So take out a three-year mortgage. It doesn't have an exploding interest rate. It goes up because the average American moves every 3 years. And you can always find somebody else because I, Alan Greenspan, am going to keep flooding the economy with enough money to make you all rich by going into debt. Well, this is the first time in history when people thought that they could get rich by going into debt. Every society until now has tried to stay out of debt, to avoid mortgaging the house, to avoid taking the risk. But now they're going into debt. We can see the disaster that would happen in America by looking at Europe, where the European Union does not have a central bank and that is monetizing the government debt. The bank laws were written by the banks to force the banks to provide all of the money that the private sector needs to grow. And sure enough, the debt has absorbed everything so that in this week's New York Review of Book, George Soros has an analysis along very similar lines saying exactly why the European Union is falling apart for that. So the phenomenon that we're facing today is debt deflation, people having to pay the debt, and it's needless. In antiquity, the rulers would have simply wiped out the debt, and people think that that's unthinkable. On this very floor in this very building on Sunday, Sheila Baer gave a talk to the alternate banking group of Occupy Wall Street and was saying how she wanted to close down Citibank. She said there's no reason at all that we could not have paid all of the insured depositors at Citibank. What would have been wiped out are the derivatives and all the gambling that don't have anything to do with real lending for goods and services. The banks lend essentially not to produce, but to against collateral to bid up real estate prices and stock prices, government spending that Randy's talking about is spent on goods and services, guns and bombs and the things governments spend money on, but also employment and roads and bridges. And so you have a completely different kind of money as opposed to bank credit, spent on different things, goods and services, as opposed to asset prices. So I wanted to give this background to conceptualize that there are two spheres of the economy. The asset sphere of real estate and financial securities as opposed to the goods and services. Economics department talks as if money is only spent on goods and services, but 99% of bank credit is spent on mortgages, bank loans, stocks, and bonds, and that is all invisible in the economics curriculum. That's why we're here today in this series of talks to fill in what you don't get in the economics department.
Thank you.